surprised with what he led off with.
The lawyers for the next case here, Kinko versus Kinko, the lawyers here, you can't do much without the lawyers. They should be in the courtroom and ready to argue.
May it please the court, Mr. Roush, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal, if I may.
How's your time?
I'm appearing this morning on behalf of Mary Downey Kinkle, and I'd like to just briefly review the facts, if I may, with the court. On June 29, 1992, Harold Kinkle, a widower and unremarried, contracted with Fidelity Investments for an IRA account. And that IRA account provided in part as follows. I understand that if I choose not to designate a beneficiary, my beneficiary will be my surviving spouse. Or if I do not have a surviving spouse, my estate. That contract further provided, I am aware that this form becomes effective when delivered to Fidelity and will remain in effect until I deliver to Fidelity another form with a later date. The contract further provided that this agreement would be construed and administered and enforced according to the laws of Massachusetts. Mr. Kinkle, when he filled out the form, didn't designate a beneficiary.
That was before he married Mary, wasn't it?
That's correct. A couple of years later, about 2.5 years later, on November 29, 1994, Harold and Mary entered into a prenuptial agreement. And attached to the prenuptial agreement were exhibits listing their separate property. And on Mr. Kinkle's exhibit was the Fidelity IRA contract or account.
The person who creates the contract is the owner of it, are they not?
That is correct.
Okay, so he owned that property at the time of the coverture.
That is correct.
It was his own separate property.
It was own separate property. And the prenuptial agreement further provided that each of the properties were free to dispose of that property as they so chose, and they specifically in that contract waived any claim that they had to the separate property of the other. But that prenuptial agreement further provided that during their lifetime they were free to dispose of that property as they so chose by sale, gift, will, or otherwise, even if contrary to the terms of the prenuptial agreement.
So was there a gift?
No.
Was there a sale?
No. It was transfer, I consider it otherwise, by other means. There are other means by which...
Is the other means inaction? Is that what you would consider it?
Yes.
And if we were to accept that proposition that an antenuptial or prenuptial agreement can be contravened or that one can act within the terms, in this case you're saying the person acted within the terms of the agreement by... but it still contravenes the intent. You know, we'll each keep our property separate unless we decide to act differently later.
Well, it's my contention that the intent of the parties would have to be gleaned from the four corners of the two contracts, both the contract with Fidelity and the contract that they had with each other, which was the antenuptial agreement.
But doesn't the antenuptial agreement override the other?
Not necessarily.
Well, why not necessarily?
It is my contention that the courts in the state of Ohio and other jurisdictions have accepted substitute beneficiary clauses. And it is my contention that the IRA contract contained a substitute beneficiary clause. And those jurisdictions have further held that in order to change the beneficiary on a contract, an IRA or retirement benefits, as far as federal law is concerned, as far as POD accounts are concerned, it must be done in the form prescribed by either the statute or by the contract that the individual had with the bank or with in this case, with Fidelity. So the, my argument is that the two contracts.
So what good is the annuptial agreement?
The annuptial agreement basically lays a foundation or a framework for the parties prior to their marriage, basically saying, what we bring into this marriage, we bring in and it is our separate property. You're giving up your claim to mine, I'm giving up your claim to yours.
But isn't that what happened with this fidelity account?
Well, but after the parties are married, they can, by will, deed, joint bank accounts, they can change beneficiaries on life insurance policy.
But he didn't do any of those things. I could see if he acquired this fidelity account after they were married and didn't designate a beneficiary, I think your argument would be stronger. But this was property owned prior to the marriage.
I understand. But it is our contention that a substitute beneficiary clause, a life insurance contract, a POD account, can only be changed or modified pursuant to the terms of the contract that the individual has with the bank.
Well, then what's wrong with their argument that you let the bank contract stand, the Fidelity pays the money over to Mary, and then Mary has a duty under her own prenup to pay the money back to the estate?
Well, our basic contention here is that there is a substitute beneficiary clause. There is a contract between the decedent and Fidelity. That contract is enforceable by the payment of the proceeds to the surviving spouse.
Right, and they pay it all over to Mary. Doesn't Mary have at least a moral obligation? Wasn't that the intent for him to keep his property? And she has an obligation under the prenup to then pay that amount back over to the estate.
It is our position that the intent needs to be gleaned from the four corners of the document. The prenuptial agreement says that you can otherwise dispose of your property after you enter into that contract. And by any time he went down there and designated his children, designated his estate, or designated the YMCA as a beneficiary on that IRA, Mary would have nothing to say about it.
How does Mary?
If, well, the, when he got the Fidelity contract, the estate was the beneficiary because he wasn't married, correct?
That is correct.
And so you're saying that the act of marriage created its own change in the contract.
And that was a holding that was in White versus McGill, where the Ohio law concerning STR benefits, or STRS benefits, was found that the clause in the statute which found that the marriage, in essence, revoked the designation that Mrs. White had made with regards to those proceeds. And then when she divorced her husband, she then had to go back and redesignate who she wanted to be the beneficiary, or the substitute beneficiary clause was then going to be applicable.
Well, then why bother putting it in the prenuptial agreement if that was his intent? Why bother?
When people come into our office to do prenuptial agreements, we advise them to put all of their separate property into the prenup, listed on the schedule. And then they waive any claim that they have to that property. But then after they're married, if they want to then make dispositions to their spouse of that separate property, they're certainly free and able to do that.
Now, that's the way it has to be, right? We know that a prenuptial agreement is not valid unless all the property is listed, right?
That's correct. That.
So your point seems to continue to return to the fact that the spouse then is free to make other dispositions.
That's correct.
That would no longer keep his property or her property separate, but could convey it to a child or a spouse. And your case is important, but it also, we will be ruling about other cases. And I'm just wondering if your suggestion here would require that once someone executes a prenuptial agreement, then they better continually check the status of all their contracts that might include some disposition by virtue of marriage, which is what the annuptial says we aren't going to have operate anymore. They'll have to continually be vigilant and look at their contracts, and the annuptial won't protect them from this sort of thing.
That is absolutely correct, because I believe the federal law statute, or the cases that I have referred to, have found that a very thing.
ERISA.
Under ERISA.
Right.
And if a person remarries and he has a separation, a prenuptial agreement, which lists those benefits as separate property, that is not sufficient to revoke the surviving spouse as the recipient of those funds.
You're not making the claim here, counsel, that the Janes case and just the mere passage of time would evidence or evince an intent by one spouse to make a gift to another, as occurred in the Janes case?
Well, I'm not specifically familiar with the facts in the Janes case, but that is not my contention, that passage of time.
You just want to use the contract language of the IRA account.
That's right. We look at the two contracts. They are wholly consistent with each other, because if you don't apply the substitute beneficiary clause and leave the proceeds to the surviving spouse, then the contract that the decedent had with Fidelity will have to be invalidated. And contracts are presumed to be valid and enforceable against the individuals who create them, and the only way that these two contracts can be read together and enforced would be to pay the proceeds of the IRA account to the substitute beneficiary.
You represent Mary?
Yes, I do.
Anybody represent Fidelity?
Fidelity paid the proceeds.
I know what Fidelity did. Anybody represent them here?
No, sir.
Mary still have the proceeds?
We have the proceeds in escrow in an account between Mr. Roush and myself.
Thank you.
We're holding them in escrow.
But doesn't she waive the right to that by signing the prenup?
She waives the right to those proceeds unless they are otherwise designated. And he did not designate.
Is that what it said in the prenup, unless otherwise designated?
No, it says unless otherwise disposed of. The exact language in the prenuptial agreement.
Does that word, verb disposed, could that word suggest some necessity of an affirmative act by the spouse? Did this, you know, could you really say that Mr. Kinkle here disposed of that property in a way other than that it was expected to go in the antenuptial? Doesn't dispose sort of suggest some affirmative act?
Well, the substitute beneficiary clause is certainly a method by which an individual can dispose of his assets.
Yeah, but that it's interesting because they correlate very well. The language of the prenuptial agreement here said you forego the right to property you would otherwise be entitled to by virtue of your marriage, something like that.
Each party hereto may make such disposition of his or her property by sale, gift, will.
No, I'm talking about the provision that says each shall keep their own.
Okay. They waive any claim that they have in the property of the other.
That you are entitled to by virtue of your marriage. This, would you agree that this, the entitlement to this, the substitute beneficiary clause, as you call it, entitles Mary to these proceeds by virtue of her marriage?
Yes.
And then, but then the other verb we have to deal with is dispose, if he has otherwise disposed. So it really is, you would have to agree, it comes to Mary by virtue of her marriage, which the antenuptial says that isn't going to work anymore. And then, but he her spouse has a right to dispose in some other way. Has he done so by just doing nothing?
It is
after the marriage.
It is our contention that he has, because the Massachusetts law, with respect, both statutory and codified, says that any change in the beneficiary must be done in a manner set forth in the contract. And there, with regards to POD accounts, it must be, the statute provides that it must be done in conformity with what the bank sets up as far as the procedure to change a beneficiary. It is our contention that if he had at any time designated any individual, his children or his estate or, as I said, the YMCA, we would not be here today, because you could look to the contract and determine who the beneficiary was. He did not designate a beneficiary. Therefore, we fall back on the substitute beneficiary clause, and it's the surviving spouse. We turn to the separation agreement. We review the otherwise disposed of clause, and certainly then the two contracts would be consistent with each other and capable of being giving validity to both the contracts. And that is basically our argument.
Thank you, Mr. Blair. Mr. Roush.
May it please the court, Mr. Blair, Mr. Yonkman. I think I'd like to begin my argument by addressing some of the points made by Mr. Blair regarding the Massachusetts statute cited in the brief and the Massachusetts case which deals with that brief, and touch upon also the federal cases he cites which talk about ERISA. The Massachusetts statute referred to by Mr. Blair states that a designated beneficiary in certain accounts, such as an IRA account like the one in the case before us, cannot be changed by some testamentary act. That Massachusetts case of Fitzpatrick versus Small, cited by appellant, deals with a case where an individual tried to change the designation of beneficiary in an IRA by his will, which was, of course, was not permitted. I would point out that you would get the same result in Ohio under those facts. I know of no authority in the state of Ohio that would permit someone to change the designation of beneficiary on an IRA account or an insurance policy, for that matter, through a will, unless there was some obscure contract pertaining to the IRA that said you can change this by will. In other words, there's no dispute that you change beneficiaries in accordance with the contract document. We're dealing with two contract documents here, the contract between Fidelity and Harold Kinkle, and we're also then dealing with a contract between the antenuptial agreement between Harold Kinkle and the appellant. The ERISA cases have absolutely nothing to do with the case before the court because we're dealing with an individual retirement account which is not included in the definition of those employer labor union plans that are governed by the body of law of ERISA, so it has no applicability to this case.
Why shouldn't the contract with the account take precedence over the agreement?
I think that our position is that contract has been performed. As the court correctly noted, that contract said that on the day that you die, Mr. Kinkle, since you have not designated a beneficiary, we're going to see if you were married the date of your death. And if you will, your surviving spouse will receive these proceeds.
Right.
And Fidelity performed its obligations under that agreement.
Why shouldn't she get the money then?
She did receive the money. And that contract has been fully performed.
Why can't she keep it?
Because she subsequently entered into a separate contract in the form of this antenuptial agreement with Mr. Kinkle, in contemplation of marriage. And then, I mean, I think if we look at the facts and how at the timing of some of these events, in June of 1992.
But she didn't go to the bank and take out money and keep it. A check was sent to her after her husband's death. She had nothing to do with her getting the money. She just accepted the money. Doesn't the agreement that is signed contemplate some type of activity on her part that she would have to do to get some of that property? Doesn't she have to be actively participating in the acquiring of the property in the agreement for her to have to give it back?
As far as the IRA, all she had to do was send in a proof of claim, proof that she was a surviving spouse and she was paid the money. Now we have to look at the contract that she entered into with Mr. Kinkle.
Right.
And that contract she expressly waived before they were married and entered into, in contemplation of marriage, any claim to his separate property. In fact, if the record below in the transcripts for deposition, she clearly stated that this agreement was entered into, quote, so that his property would be his and mine would be mine, end quote.
So if any piece of property listed in the agreement happens to find its way into her lap, she's got to give it back?
Unless the agreement does provide for certain property items under the agreement to be transferred in contravention of the terms of that agreement, which has been spoken to by Mr. Blair. It was by sale, gift, or otherwise. And Mr. Blair's sole argument is that, I mean, there's no question this money was not gifted to the appellant.
But I can't get past the fact that Mr. Blair had to do something with the IRA to deviate it going to his new wife. And he did nothing. Isn't that some indication on her part that he intended that property go to the new wife by not taking any action?
Well, I think that our position would be that, and that's basically the sum and substance of Mr. Blair's argument, which is, you know, how do you get around the fact that she signed a valid contract, which has never, it's been conceded to be valid
at all stages?
How do you
get around the fact that he didn't change his beneficiary?
Well, the records with the IRA contract with Fidelity are quite clear. When he opened it in June of 92, he left all designation of beneficiary blank spaces blank, which meant by the terms, if he had a surviving spouse at the time of his death, it would go to her. Well, when he opened that account in 92, he was an unremarried widower, had no spouse.
So by the terms of that contract, he knew it would go to his estate.
Yes, that contract clearly provided, had he died at any time between June of 1992 and the date that he married the appellant, there's no question that those proceeds would have went directly to his estate. We talk about intent, and I believe that the argument of appellant is simply, as he's clearly stated here today, after he married, by not changing the beneficiary or taking some affirmative act, he therefore intended that those funds go to the appellant. So his inaction now constitutes action. But that ignores two key facts. First one we've just spoke about, and that is, when he formed the IRA in June of 1992, he either knew the appellant or he didn't. If he did know her, he didn't include her as the beneficiary. That clearly evidences an intent that she not receive the funds. If he didn't know her, he clearly couldn't have intended that she receive those funds. Because this is 1992. 2.5 years later, they get married. But before they get married, 4 days before they get married, and in contemplation of that marriage, Mr. Kinkle reaffirmed his intention as to what happens with that IRA and the proceeds contained therein. He said, he listed it specifically in this agreement. It's listed in his assets by name, account number, and amount, along with his other assets, that this is my property. There was a list from Mrs. Kinkle listing her property. They both clearly waived any claim to the other property of the other party during the term of the agreement, during the lifetime of the other party, or thereafter. So, I mean, I think this clearly shows that he could have clearly designated her or accepted it out at the time he did the IRA, or the antenuptial agreement, but he didn't. If he wanted, and we've got two expressions of his intent on where that property go. When he created it, it goes to his estate. When he does the antenuptial agreement, it's his free and clear to be handled through his will. If he wanted and intended that the appellant receive these funds, been a lot of easier things he could have done. He could have sent in a beneficiary designation clause at that point, designated the appellant as the beneficiary of those funds. He could have amended the antenuptial agreement to exclude that particular account from the operation of the provisions of that agreement. He could have terminated the antenuptial agreement. He could have simply changed his will, specifying that the proceeds from that account be distributed to the appellant instead of to his two adult children, which is the way the will was set up. But he didn't do any of those things. So I think his intent, which we've seen on two prior occasions, was clearly set forth that that was his property and that she, the appellant, had waived any right or claim to any of the property that he had acquired prior to his marriage unless he did something further after the execution of that agreement in their marriage.
Would it be fair to say that your proposition is that the prenuptial agreement prevails over any other contract previously entered into, regardless of the language of the contract?
Not, I would say not regardless of the language of the contract. For example, if this IRA account said, had some provision in it that said, even though you're not married when you open this account, if you subsequently become married, we will acknowledge that you're going to have to do something different to change our paying your new surviving spouse.
And the parties did. He drew the agreement. He listed this particular asset as his own.
No, but I'm just saying.
That would prevail even over that language that you've just given me?
No.
Wouldn't?
I don't think it necessarily would.
See, that's the position we're in when we decide this case. It's going to, in effect, bless for all things prenuptial agreements if that's how we decide.
I think that there could be, I don't believe this is the case. I mean, I've seen in any of the cases involving life insurance, beneficiary changes, or IRAs or anything of that nature. You start out with the premise you can change the beneficiary in certain factions, in certain manners that might otherwise you wouldn't see, like by will. But in this case, the IRA specifically rules the actions of the parties after that case. I think that in order for the appellant to prevail on these facts, this court has to basically rule that even though parties enter into a valid antenuptial agreement, which is enforceable under the laws of the state of Ohio, that's not enough. Because in certain situations, in this case, an IRA account, maybe who knows what other situations, those parties, even though they've just said, what's mine is mine and yours is yours, and you don't have any claim in any of my property that you might otherwise obtain by reason of this marriage, you have to go out further and make or take some other affirmative act.
Okay, well, I ask you the question because your third proposition of law says Ohio law does not require any additional affirmative acts by the parties to a valid antenuptial agreement in order to effectuate the terms thereof.
I agree with that statement.
That's pretty broad, isn't it? So the answer to the question, I think, is even if there are contra terms in a prior agreement, the prenuptial agreement trumps.
Clearly, that it would, on the facts as applied to this case, that's absolutely true.
Wasn't that the whole intent of an antenuptial agreement? It speaks to prospectively rights one will acquire by virtue of the marriage or as a result of the marriage.
It's alterating.
It's supposed to be a superseding contract in essence. It supersedes items or property you might acquire by operation of law. Should it supersede all contracts?
I think it clearly should. I mean, we've seen in this court in its decision in Troha versus Sneller that in an antenuptial agreement, the court has ruled that parties to a valid agreement, and you got to keep in mind, it's got to be a valid antenuptial agreement, which we are dealing with here. That's been conceded.
I'm sitting here thinking that it's significant, the fact that Mr. Kinkle attached this particular contract with the antenuptial agreement showing that he did in fact have this IRA. But then on the other hand, and you said what's his is his and what's hers is hers, mm-hmm. Under the terms of that contract of the IRA, it says if you do not designate a beneficiary and you leave a spouse, proceeds go to the spouse.
That's correct.
So it would appear that you could argue, and that's what your adversary is doing is the fact that, in effect, that was her property upon his death, according to the terms of that contract.
Clearly was payable to her by fidelity upon the death of Mr. Kinkle, her being the surviving spouse.
And you would think that he would have to have sent to the IRA, to Fidelity, a copy of that antenuptial agreement to show that something was done.
I don't know that Fidelity, I think the only difference would be instead of them paying the fees to appellant, they would have filed the declaratory judgment action because their contract obligates them. They don't have a contract with the appellant. They've got a contract with Mr. Kinkle, and they're not going to look at this. They don't care what his intent is. They're just going to look at who did he say was going to get the funds. And if he didn't say it, if he was married on the day he died, they get it. I see my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Roush.
Thank you.
Mr. Blair, you've saved about a half a minute of your time.
May it please the court, just briefly. What we're asking the court to do here is to adopt what the Massachusetts court in Fitzpatrick versus Small adopted was the policy of transactional finality, which basically is a policy that says that that they've applied to retirement plans, including IRA accounts, which basically states that we look to the four corners of the document, the IRA contract, for the beneficiary. This policy eliminates the possibility of fraud and duress and the necessity of trying to determine what the individual's intent actually was. And therefore, that's what we're asking this court to do, is to adopt that policy that has been adopted in the state of Massachusetts in that Fitzpatrick versus Small. I see that my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Blair. The case is submitted, and you'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.